Graham, thank you very much, and thank you for all of the work that you've done that's given you the capability to give us the summary that you have this afternoon. If we were to take what you have presented to this group and we were to look at how we could use it legally, I think there's a lot of fruit on the tree there. Silverstein's clip is certainly an admission against penal interest and could be used. Jennings' interviews and his statements virtually come close to being excited utterances, since they happened at the time, around the time that he had the experience. So he's unavailable, so that that film material could be used in conjunction with reporters authenticating it who actually interviewed him and who interviewed Silverstein. I think the number of first responders who are on record as having heard explosions throughout those three buildings is very impressive. There seems to have been a serious possibility that has been overlooked, and that the buildings were all wired, and that they were all wired in advance. This is not something one does in a short period of time. To bring effective wiring into place, from what I understand, not at all having the expertise, but having heard this from others, would require a planned effort over quite a period of time in advance of the explosions themselves. And it's a very sophisticated job indeed. What you have described does appear to be an internal wiring operation that was triggered at a point in time, either, as you said, to weaken the structure so that debris could have an impact on it and bring it down, or to actually begin to cause it to fall itself. The firemen that you have interviewed could certainly be brought in, and statements could be taken from them under oath, as well as they could their superiors be brought to testify. So I think this has not been done. Obviously, NIST didn't do this, and there has been no proceeding that's effectively done this. So I think it's... It would be an important legal exercise to engage massively in this kind of discovery and put on the record in detail what you have uncovered, and I thank you for that effort. We're dealing with expert witnesses in a sense. So our next expert is Kevin Ryan. Kevin is going to focus on the official theory that fire brought down Building 7. He worked for Underwriters Laboratories, otherwise known as UL, and discussed that the company had provided the fire resistance information for the World Trade Center buildings. Starting in 2003, he spent a year asking questions within the company, in an effort to reconcile the facts about that testing with the facts about the unprecedented destruction of the buildings. Kevin felt that the answers to such questions were vital to the discovery of the truth about what happened on 9/11, and that those answers should also be important to his company. He asked UL to make a public statement to clarify the issues in the interests of public safety. Since UL was the public safety guardian, it seemed obvious to Kevin that the company would want to set the record straight about the glaring discrepancies between its test results and the performance of the buildings in the fires on 9/11. Instead, UL asked Kevin to wait for the report it was helping to produce as part of the investigation led by NIST. Kevin waited until late 2004, after UL had conducted testing for NIST investigation and NIST had released a presentation on its first draft and final report. But the report raised even more questions for Kevin, so he wrote directly to NIST. In appreciation for his diligence and his effort, he was fired. After he allowed his letter to become public, and he was let go. So he's been working ever since to reveal the truth of this this dilemma. And ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Kevin Ryan.
Thank you. Thanks very much. It's an honor to be introduced by William Pepper, as Graham said. I want to thank the organizers and the 9/11 families for being here today, and all of you, of course. So I'm going to speak about the evolution of the firebase theory for World Trade Center Building 7. And I use the word theory, whereas Professor McQueen used the word hypothesis, because I'm giving NIST the benefit of the doubt in that they said they tested this hypothesis, and that is now an established theory. And we've heard from Professor Queen on foreknowledge, the existence of foreknowledge for this destruction. It might be more interesting to you, as Graham said, that foreknowledge was in light of the struggle that NIST went through for years to establish a firebase theory and how unusual the final theory was. During my talk, I'll try to convey 7 points. I'll discuss how the destruction of Building 7 was unprecedented, how the steel evidence was destroyed or left unexplained, and how the final theory given by the National Institute of Standards and Technology came only after years of failed hypotheses. I'll also go into detail on the final theory from NIST and show how it could not have been predicted, how it is self-contradictory and contradicts other known facts about the building and about behavior of a building in a fire. And finally, I will summarize how NIST report was deceptive in many ways and how NIST final theory is unscientific and false. I'll cover NIST report only up to the point of collapse initiation, and my colleague Tony Zambotti will take it from there, and he'll discuss the structural aspects and dynamics of building collapse and the NIST report in that respect. So again, it's a non-controversial fact that the destruction of Building 7 was unprecedented. Both of the major investigative bodies of the government made statements to that effect. FEMA, the first investigative body, said the performance of Building 7 is significant because it appears the collapse was due primarily to fire rather than any impact damage from the collapsing towers. This was when they published their report in 2002. And NIST said this was the first known instance of total collapse of a tall building, primarily due to fires. And as we've discussed already today, there have been many fires in tall buildings over a period of more than 100 years. But there's not been one instance outside of 9/11 in which a building has suffered complete global collapse from anything other than demolition. Even on 9/11, not all the buildings that were on fire suffered global collapse. Here we see Building 5 on the upper left, which experienced bigger fires relative to its size and did not collapse as Building 7 did. On the upper right, you see that Building 5 was still standing. On the lower left, you see Building 7 burning on 9/11, and on the lower right, Building 7 having been completely destroyed after that fire. Government scientists spent years trying to offer non-explosive explanations for the destruction of Building 7. The most influential hypotheses and the most long-lasting included one that said that fires fed by diesel fuel tanks within the building were responsible for generating extraordinary heat. The New York Times reported that massive structural beams that functioned as a sort of bridge to hold up the 47-story Building 7 were compromised in a disastrous blaze fed by diesel fuel, leading to the building's collapse, investigators have concluded in a preliminary report. That article from the New York Times was not exactly accurate. They were reporting on the FEMA report for Building 7, which did not reach conclusions. And although the report suggested that diesel fuel might have played a role, it also said that this best hypothesis has only a low probability of occurrence. So basically, FEMA said that loss of structural integrity was caused by fires on the 5th to 7th floors. That's important because that changed as well. The specifics of the fires and how they caused the building to collapse remain unknown at this time, although the total diesel fuel in the premises contained massive potential energy and the best hypothesis has a low probability of occurrence. They were supported by popular media, Popular Mechanics specifically, which said that investigators believe the fire was fed by tanks of diesel fuel. You may know that this book by Popular Mechanics is often referred to by people who are supporting the official story. And Shyam Sunder, who was mentioned before, said our current working hypothesis is that this pressurized line was supplying fuel to the building and the fire for a long period of time. Although this hypothesis was promoted for years, neither the diesel fuel nor the transfer girder failure made it into the final theory. Diesel fuels were not the cause, as NIST said. Diesel fuel fires did not play a role in the collapse of Building 7. Damage from the falling Tower 1 was also not the cause. That was often referred to. Other than initiating the fires in Building 7, the damage from the debris from Tower 1 had little effect on initiating the collapse of Building 7. And again, the design of the building over the Con Ed substation with the transfer girders you see in the diagram below, that was also not the cause. What scientists and forensic investigators usually do is look for evidence. We know that there was no precedent for such an event, but what evidence do we have for a fire-based theory? Unfortunately, most of the physical evidence was destroyed, and NIST said that no steel samples from Building 7 were available for its investigation. That was not true, and we'll see that. Additionally, NIST collected thousands of photos and videos from the public over a period of years and kept them hidden from the public. They have only recently released some of those. We also have documents that establish the fire resistance plan for the building, and that is important evidence related to a fire-based theory. Important evidence also could have been gained through physical testing of steel components. Unfortunately, no such testing was done, despite the fact that the testing would have been relatively easy and straightforward. In the end, this theory was based entirely on computer modeling. As we see here, the U.S. House Committee on Science reported on the destruction of the steel evidence. They said in the month that lapsed between the terrorist attacks and the deployment of the FEMA team, a significant amount of steel debris was removed from the rubble pile, cut into smaller sections, and either melted at the recycling plant or shipped out of the U.S. Some of the critical pieces of steel were gone before the first FEMA team member ever reached the site. This unprecedented destruction of evidence continued throughout the cleanup effort, even when the investigators were there. A good question that remains unanswered is why did official investigators, including the National Institute for Standards and Technology, not follow the national standard for fire investigation? Part of the standard, which is called NFP 921, states that it is essential to prevent the destruction or removal of evidence. That may seem obvious to most of us. Removal of the evidence may have had something to do with the nature of the evidence itself. NIST told us that not one piece of steel from this huge building was left for its investigation, but that was not true, as I said. This sample was photographed by a professor from the University of California in Berkeley. He had been granted access to areas near Ground Zero through a National Science Foundation project. He examined a number of unusual samples as early as 1 week after 9/11, and this sample looks like it has some odd burns or cuts in the steel, and that same professor later stated that he saw melted girders at the World Trade Center. When the official FEMA investigators were finally admitted to the site, they found some very unusual samples of steel. The New York Times reported on perhaps the deepest mystery uncovered in the investigation. This mystery referred to thin pieces of steel discovered by FEMA investigators that were found to exhibit sulfidation and evidence of a eutectic formation that could not be explained by any of the FireWise professors. They had never seen it before. A eutectic formation is a chemical mixture that melts at a lower temperature than its individual components. In this case, it was a mixture of iron, oxygen, and sulfur. The FEMA investigators reported that the severe corrosion and subsequent erosion of samples 1, which was from Building 7, and 2, are a very unusual event. No clear explanation for the source of the sulfur has been identified. The rate of corrosion is also unknown. A detailed study into the mechanisms of this phenomenon is needed. Additional photos from the FEMA report are here. It was reported that a 1-inch steel column had been reduced to half-inch thickness. Its edges, curled like a paper scroll, have been thinned to almost razor sharpness. Gaping holes let light shine through a formerly solid steel flange. And the Swiss cheese appearance shocked all the FireWise professors, who expected to see distortion and bending, but not holes. The detailed study recommended by these FireWise professors and FEMA never got done, and NIST never mentioned any of this mystery in its final report. And although this presentation will not go into detail on it, independent scientists have proposed answers through a series of peer-reviewed scientific articles, which you can find online. The NIST investigation began just after the publication of the FEMA World Trade Center report in May 2002. The investigation proceeded for 2 years until 2004, when NIST decided to decouple its report on Building 7 from its investigation into the towers. In any case, we can say that the NIST investigation into Building 7 proceeded for at least 5 years, from 2002 to 2004, and then from 2005 to 2008. This is despite NIST's claim that its investigation lasted for only those final 3 years. At some point during the 6-year period between NIST's charter and its final report on Building 7, the objective seemed to change. Originally, the specific objective of the NIST investigation for Building 7 was to explain why and how Building 7 collapsed. Then later, NIST said the challenge was to determine if a fire-induced floor system failure could occur in Building 7 under an ordinary building contents fire. Now, this suggests that NIST started with assumptions and that they were going to try to prove a fire-based theory, regardless of what they found. By December 2003, investigators had obtained a great deal of information on the building. And their report said that hypotheses have been postulated for the collapse of the building. NIST is analyzing these and other possible structural collapse sequences as part of its investigation. Detailed mappings for the fires and so forth are underway for Building 7. And as I said, NIST had also started gathering thousands of photos and videos, which they effectively kept away from the public. In June 2004, NIST published an interim report on Building 7, and they presented what they called a working hypothesis. It was basically the diesel fuel fire idea, the truss girders and floors 5 through 7, if it holds up upon further analysis. NIST might have wanted to gloss over its first 2 years of investigation into Building 7 because it did not want to acknowledge some of the things, ultimately, in its 2004 interim report that contradicted its final report. At the time of the 2004 interim report, NIST was still looking at many different hypotheses. None of these hypotheses, or any of NIST's earlier reports, had much to do with the final theory, and none of them had anything to do with explosives. shocking admission was made 2 years after the 2004 interim report by NIST lead investigator Chaim Sunder, who made it clear that they had little or no idea what happened to Building 7 at that time. This is very startling in the fact that, and by 2006, construction had been completed on a new Building 7 that was placed in the exact same location. It was 52 stories tall. It took 4 years to complete, and we still didn't know what happened to the first one. But this was 4 years after NIST began its investigation. So again, as Professor Graham pointed out, we should wonder how anyone could have predicted this building would collapse, given that 4 years into the investigation, government scientists had no idea how it happened. But NIST suddenly told us in 2008 that it was all obvious and that science was behind it. We're going to take a close look at NIST's final theory and discover for ourselves whether or not it's obvious. NIST's final reports for Building 7 came out in 2008. These were NIST NC Star 1A, the final report, and NIST NC Star 19, the supportive documentation, larger reports behind that. These can be found online at wtc.nist.gov, and they are about 900 pages in total. So please do look at them. They're not quite as large as the report for the towers. But here's the gist of the overall theory that NIST proposed. Fire-induced thermal expansion of the floor system surrounding column 79 led to the collapse of floor 13, which triggered a cascade of floor failures. In this case, the floor beams on the east side, actually on the northeast corner of the building, expanded enough that they pushed the girder spanning between columns 79 and 44 to the west on the 13th floor. This movement was enough for the girder to walk off its support at column 79. The lower left diagram is kind of a depiction of what they're trying to say there, and how NIST envisions the girder being pushed by a beam. And the result was that the unsupported girder and other local fire-induced damage caused floor 13 to collapse, beginning a cascade of floor failures down to the fifth floor. I'm not going to actually talk about that. We'll leave that to Tony. But the diagram on the lower right is a depiction of that, with the column, the critical column, being left unsupported and then buckling. So one thing we might begin with is, since NIST collapse initiation sequence begins with thermal expansion, and to be more specific, linear thermal expansion of the floor beams, we must ask, is thermal expansion a new phenomenon, as NIST has implied? The answer is absolutely not. The thermal expansion is well known, and its effects on building components have been tested. One well-known series of tests occurred in the UK at the Cardington Fire Test Facility. Tests done at Cardington under severe fire conditions showed that floor beams will deflect downward in response to thermal expansion. This is particularly true because the floor beams are made composite with the floor assemblies, as we'll discuss. And this means that shear studs are used to attach the beams to the floors and make them one piece. Without the studs, the beams could also deflect laterally or sideways to relieve the stress of expansion. So what does NIST say happened in Building 7? Here's a photo of the area showing the critical column, column 79. NIST says fires on floor 12 heated the ceiling that included the floor beams for floor 13, causing thermal expansion of the beams, which pushed the girder at column 79 off its seat. And from there, everything just fell apart. You can see the girder here with its seat and the floor beams that are connected to it. Here's another diagram from the NIST report that shows NIST's view of how the floor beams on the northeast side of the building, shown here as purple lines, pushed against the critical girder. The girder connected column 79 to the external wall at column 44. The girder to column connection is blown up in the inset diagram, showing how NIST envisions that the girder was pushed off its seat. We can see the holes for the bolts in the seat, but what we can't see is that there were two bolts in the lower seat connection and two bolts in the upper clip connection, making four bolts at the column girder connection. On the bottom here, you can see the pictures that NIST used in its media presentation, Shyam Sunder, when it unveiled its final report. The picture is reversed with respect to the diagram above, but you can see the general idea. NIST told us in 2004 about shear studs that connected the beams and the girders to the floor assemblies above them. This is how the beams and the girders are made composite with the floors. You can see in the diagram here how the studs connected the floors to the beams or girders. The NIST interim report said that most of the beams and girders were made composite with the slabs using shear studs. The exception, they pointed out, was a lack of drawing notes for core girders, and the girder in question is not a core girder, meaning it was not within the core section of the building, but was connected to the external wall. Unfortunately, NIST changed its mind on this with its final report. NIST did a reversal, and they said that no studs were installed on the girders. This point is very important to NIST's theory. Unfortunately for NIST, it was not just its own 2004 interim report that contradicted this vital aspect of the final theory. The presence of shear studs on that critical girder was also described by John Selvarinus, who was the project manager for Building 7 from the company that supplied the steel components. Selvarinus wrote an academic paper about Building 7 in 1986, describing the construction in detail. NIST referred to that paper, as I show here, in its interim report, but did not mention it in its final report. That may be because this diagram from Selvarinus' paper shows where the author indicated the presence of 30 shear studs on that critical girder. But how could thermal expansion cause the breakage of what would be 28 shear studs on each of the five floor beams, 30 shear studs on the critical girder, and four bolts connecting the girder to column 79. The mechanism NIST proposed is called differential thermal expansion. This is where the expansion of the beam is much greater than the expansion of the floor above it, and it causes shear stress. The expansion actually moves in both directions, but NIST said the external wall was strong enough to withstand it, so all of that expansion moved towards the critical girder. Because thermal expansion is a function of temperature, again, we need to take a look, as we did with the Cardington test results, to see if it's a new phenomenon, as NIST suggests. But you can see that it's actually been a consideration throughout history, as these two building professionals from Australia pointed out when they wrote a response to NIST on the Building 7 report. These building professionals reported that they had actually done physical tests to see what thermal expansion would do to floor assemblies that were bolted to floor beams and girders. These were just the kinds of tests that NIST should have done. Because they had actually done the test, the Australians were able to state that what NIST proposed was not their experience at all, and that they did not agree with it. The shear studs would not fail because the floor slab was heated as well, and since the concrete in the floor slab has an expansion coefficient that's very nearly the same as steel, the entire composite would expand together. So NIST's final theory is at odds with actual experimental evidence from the testing of real floor assemblies. Another thing we have to take a look at is just how far that girder would have had to be pushed for it to walk off its seat, as NIST suggests. NIST reported that the seat at column 79 was 11 inches wide. The structural diagrams actually say the seat was 12 inches wide, but we won't bicker on that because you'll soon see that it doesn't matter. If we assume that the seat was 11 inches wide, NIST says the girder had to be pushed at least 5.5 inches or half of that distance to walk off the seat. And the reason they say that is that they need what's called the web, or the vertical section in the middle of the beam, to actually push all the way to the edge so that the most of the mass of the girder would fall. The majority of the mass would fall. So half the distance has to be reached. Let's take a look at what temperature NIST says the beams reach so that we can estimate how much they expanded. This was a tricky question for NIST, and we can see throughout its report on Building 7 that NIST struggled with this answer. It was tricky because at temperatures as high as 600 degrees Celsius, which NIST says the floor beams reached on the south and east areas of floor 12, the steel will lose strength and stiffness and therefore not be able to extend and push into the girder. At the same time, if the temperature is not high enough, there won't be enough expansion of the beams. What NIST settled on was the idea that just on the northeast corner of floor 12, the beam temperatures only reached 400 degrees Celsius. Apparently, NIST investigators felt that with this distribution of temperatures in their computer models, they could show that the critical beams on the northeast side would remain rigid, whereas all the other floor beams on the south and east areas of floor 12 would be hot enough. Actually, floor 13, the ceiling of floor 12, would be hot enough so that when the girder on the northeast fell off, the floors would be ready to collapse in unison. Again, it's hard to believe that anybody could have ever predicted any of this. But on this slide, you can see another example of just how tenuous NIST computer models were with respect to reality. NIST computer model had the steel reaching extreme temperatures and all the bolts and other connections failing within a matter of about 2 seconds. This is an example of how NIST computer modeling was not realistic. Once the temperature distribution needed for the theory was settled, NIST found a way to suggest that the differential thermal expansion could be possible, at least in the computer. They simply didn't heat the floor slab. You can see here that despite NIST's claim in several parts of its report that the beams on the northeast corner reached a temperature of only 400 degrees, in the computer model, the beams on the northeast corner were heated to 600 degrees. More importantly, the floor slabs were left unheated. So if you heat the floor beams to an extreme temperature and leave the slab unheated, there will be differential thermal expansion, but only in the computer. This is what most scientists would call fraud. But NIST theory has more problems than that. Given NIST temperature scenario, the amount of expansion by the beams would not satisfy the amount of expansion that NIST said was required. NIST provided an example of the equation that scientists use to calculate thermal expansion. This equation requires only the length of the object, the coefficient of expansion for that material, and the change in temperature. NIST's example here uses the girder length of 45 feet, and they used 600 degrees Celsius in this example, but neither of these values are applicable to the initiating event. If we put the right values in the equation, including the length of the beam, which was 53 feet, the change in temperature for the beams, not the temperature they reached, but the change on the northeast corner from room temperature to 400 degrees, we see that the maximum expansion would be 3.3 inches. That's all it can do. And the 3.3 inches would not be enough to cause the girder to walk off its seat. Therefore, NIST theory is not only disproven by the actual physical tests performed by the Australians, it's disproven in theory as well. Despite the fact that we have already seen that NIST theory is unrealistic, we should look further to get a better picture of how NIST was able to convince people that it was realistic. One thing NIST said was that there were 7-hour fires in Building 7, which gave the impression that the fires were very long and very hot. It seems odd, on a side note, that NIST computer simulation covered a time period beyond the actual collapse of the building, going to 6 p.m. In any case, photographs show that fires were known to exist on some floors as early as just after noon. Those early photographs did not show fires on the floors of interest, which are now floors 11 through 13, until after 2 p.m. So the evidence shows, the first evidence shows, fires on those floors after 2 p.m. How the fires in Building 7 started is even a mystery. Some buildings that were damaged by falling debris did not have fires. For example, the Deutsche Bank building, some people may know, was severely damaged over a long stretch of the building, but did not have any fires. And this suggested two scenarios for starting the fires in Building 7. So they actually haven't settled on one of these. The first was that falling debris from the North Tower started the fires in some unexplained impact manner. Due to the design of the building, fires could not be spread from floor to floor, so the scenario would require that at least 10 separate fires, because we saw fires on 10 floors, were started separately through the impact damage on the northwest side, which is where the impact damage was. The second scenario NIST suggested was that because fires were burning on the ground around Building 7, whatever ignition sources caused those fires might have entered into Building 7, again through the damaged areas, and started fires in Building 7. So they weren't really sure. There were some unusual fires burning in the area around Building 7. Here you can see some of the vehicles on the east side, just outside the building. These fires burned so hot that the tires, the plastic parts, and the interiors were all gone afterward. Unusual fires in the area around Building 7 show cars and other metallic-looking objects burning or appearing to burn. I captured this image on the lower right of fire emerging from the east side of Building 7 from a video released by NIST this last year. It shows an odd blue flame bursting from one of the videos. I should have tried to, one of the windows, I should have tried to insert the video, but I didn't. It's very interesting. Although there's not one temperature for a blue flame, it typically is indicative of a fire in which the temperatures reach several thousands of degrees Celsius. Definitely not a typical office fire. Another NIST deception is that NIST tells us the fires on the lower floors were not put out by firefighters because there was no water available to do so. However, the building was only two blocks from fireboats on the Hudson River, and lack of water was certainly not a problem for firefighting efforts in the area. As these photos show, firefighters in the area seem to have plenty of water to fight the fires in Building 6 and Building 3, but they left Building 7 to burn. Building 7 had an internal water system to supply the sprinklers on floor 21 through 47, but the water for the sprinkler system on floors 1 through 20 was supplied by the city water system, which had been damaged by falling debris. Building 7 also had Siamese fittings, which allowed water from external sources to charge the sprinkler system on the lower 20 floors. So we can only speculate as to why this was not done. The sprinklers were not the only part of the fire resistance plan for Building 7. As these excerpts from the NIST report show, the sprinklers were only the first line of defense against the fire, but the second line of defense was the passive fire protection or fireproofing. This is how I came to be aware of the problems at the World Trade Center, because my former company, Underwriters Laboratories, is the source of fire resistance information that engineers and architects used to select building components. As you can see here, there were requirements for fire resistance of the columns and floor steel in Building 7, just as there is for any skyscraper. The requirements were that these steel components must withstand at least 2 to 3 hours of intense fire in standard tests. This photo shows a little bit of the fireproofing scraped away, so you can see how that's applied. Through testing in Underwriters Laboratories, the steel components are given the fire resistance ratings based on thickness of fireproofing material that is applied. The NIST report for Building 7 gives these values from the UL Fire Resistance Directory. The NIST report also confirms that fireproofing was applied correctly and was not damaged by falling debris, at least not in the areas where the failure is said to have occurred. So how long does it take fireproof steel to reach the temperatures reported by NIST? This first statement from NIST says that temperatures of around 500 to 600 degrees Celsius, which they said were reached by steel in the building, would take roughly 6 hours of continuous exposure from a fully developed fire. Of course, 6 hours is much longer than 2 seconds in the computer model. NIST said the beams in the area of first failure reached only 400 degrees, as we discussed, so that is why NIST claimed that the critical damage state was reached in 3.5 to 4 hours. One big contradiction that NIST avoided is that its investigators knew that the fire load in the building would only support about 20 minutes of fire in a given location. When they talk about 3 or 4 or 7 hours of fire, they are at most speaking of the time a fire lasts anywhere on a given floor, not in a specific location on a floor. Underneath a floor beam, for example, the fire time is only about 20 minutes, as this exchange from a NIST advisory committee meeting indicates. One member of the advisory committee asked, "Fire moved every 20 minutes. Essentially, it started and stopped every 20 minutes. So if you do not have fuel in Building 7, how could fires burn for as long as they had and taken out this major structure that had good fireproofing?" The answer from the ever-popular Dr. Sunder, was that the fires moved from location to location, meaning that at any given location, the combustibles needed about 20 minutes to be consumed. While the combustibles at a location were being consumed, the fire front would be progressing to adjacent combustibles. That's a long way around saying that, yes, there were 20 minutes worth of combustibles in a given location. In any case, the fires proceeded without being fought, and NIST needed to estimate pathways and temperatures of the fires. They began this process by estimating the fire load on each floor. One of the unusual things that NIST did in this regard was that it estimated the fire load on floors 11 and 12 to be 50% higher than on any other floors in the building. NIST first made this estimate in its August 2008 draft report, then based it on interviews with American Express managers who described the level of furnishings as high. American Express occupied the southwest corner of floor 13, and it was not clear how they would know about floor 11 and 12. So NIST changed the source of this claim in its final report to say that it was the Securities and Exchange Commission managers, which actually did occupy floors in 11 and 12, that made this high estimate. And then NIST simply estimated the fire load on floor 13 by saying it was assumed to be the same as the floor 11 and 12 fire load. And they did this because they said there wasn't much information on floor 13. And again, going back to NFPA 921, the national standard for fire investigation, speculative information like this cannot be included in an analysis. It was all pretty confusing for anyone trying to follow the story. And again, we should note that NIST was not following that standard, and NIST methods were certainly not scientific. Anyway, NIST took these assumed fire loads in along with other parameters, like the thermal conductivities and the densities of the materials involved, the details about the building structure and connections, and they put it all into a series of computer experiments. As we can see here, NIST computer simulations are actually the result of 4 separate computer models, each one built on an entirely different software and used for different things. There was a fire dynamics simulator that was used to simulate the fires and estimate gas temperatures. And then a program called Fire Structure Interface was used to estimate the temperatures imposed on the structural components. There was a finite element analysis model called ANSYS that estimated structural responses. This is where NIST proposed 3 thermal cases to study. Case A, in which the temperatures were taken directly from the two previous simulations. Case B, which used arbitrarily chosen temperatures that were higher than those generated by the previous simulations. And case C, which used lower temperatures. Not surprisingly, case B, with the higher temperatures, was what NIST settled on. Finally, the worst-case scenarios from the ANSYS model were fed into a global analysis program called LS-DYNA. We see here that NIST talked about photographs and fire times in its 2004 report. This shows that around 3 p.m., fires were being observed in the northeast area of floor 12. These fires on floor 12 appeared to be already past the northeast corner, moving west along the north face. And again, it's in the northeast corner of floor 12 where the initiating event occurred. In fact, the 2004 report says the fires actually bypassed the northeast corner of 12. But another interesting statement in this interim report said that the fires on floor 12 were entirely burned out at 4:45 p.m. That was 35 minutes before the building came down. So NIST interim report contradicts the idea that fires were raging at 5:20 p.m. It turns out that NIST did not use the photographs in its computer simulations. As you can see from this comparison of a photo in NIST report, taken at about 3:50 p.m., and the NIST simulation of fires on floor 12, there is no correlation between NIST simulation and what really happened. At approximately 4 o'clock, NIST simulation shows raging fires across the north side windows of floor 12. The photo from about the same time shows no fires in that area. NIST admits that its models did not use the observed fire activity from photos and videos as a model input. So again, this is not science. Just how long did the fires last in the northeast areas of floor 12, where NIST said the initial failures occurred? NIST theory requires fires that lasted 4 hours in those areas. And although NIST refers to observed events, they're trying to match things to observed events, there's no one who observed the girder fall off or column 79 buckle. But the evidence indicates that the fires on those floors began on the south side of the building, as we saw, after 2 p.m., and in the northeast corner of floor 12, the fires were out sometime before 3:49 p.m., probably closer to 3:15. So there's no evidence for a four-hour fire on floor 12 at 5:20 or at any other time. Again, the photographic evidence tells us that the fires on the northeast corner of floor 12 burned out nearly 2 hours before the building fell. So let's review some of the deceptions we've seen in the NIST report for Building 7. NIST said that there were no Building 7 steel samples, but those samples were available. They were just left unexplained. NIST said that they took 3 years for their investigation, but they took at least 5 years. NIST said that there were 7 hours fires in Building 7, but evidence suggests the fires were much shorter in duration. NIST said that there was no water to put out the fires, but Building 7 sprinklers were functional and water was available. NIST said that there were four-hour fires in the northeast floor of 12, northeast corner of floor 12, but only 20 minutes of combustibles were available in any given location. And we've seen that the duration from photos could not have been as long. NIST said there were no shear studs on the girder. This is contradicted by NIST's own interim report and by the building project manager, Salvarinas. NIST did not use photos of fire as model input. That's because the photos showed the fires were out. And NIST said the floor slab was not heated in their model, or NIST did not actually heat the floor slab in their model, and differential thermal expansion cannot be measured without heating both the beam and the slab. And other than the deceptions, here are the reasons why NIST's final theory is unscientific and false. NIST ignored previous findings on the Building 7 steel samples. No physical tests were done to confirm the mechanisms NIST proposed. Other physical tests have shown that NIST mechanisms are unrealistic. The fire theory is contradicted by the known fire resistance plan. The fires in Building 7 lasted only 20 minutes in a given location, while the steel components were rated for hours of fire resistance. NIST's final theory was based entirely on computer simulations that are not based on evidence. The fire initiation, fire spread, and fire loads were based on Arbitrary assumptions. The case B assumption used was arbitrary and biased. NIST fire modeling contradicts the photographic evidence. The fires in the critical area were out long before collapse. NIST contradicted itself and known facts about shear studs on that critical girder, and the maximum thermal expansion possible could not have caused the girder to walk off its seat. Another indirect reason why NIST Building 7 investigation report is false is that building professionals around the world have not incorporated changes in building codes to prevent the devastating thermal expansion that NIST says took place. Existing buildings have not been retrofitted to prevent that occurrence either. Some of the tower recommendations on the towers were considered for the internet by the International Building Code Committee, but not the one new recommendation from the World Trade Center 7 report. That new recommendation was that NIST recommends that building be explicitly evaluated to ensure the adequate performance of structural system under infrequent design fires with any active fire protection system rendered ineffective for thermal expansion. And again, there have been no reported changes to skyscrapers around the world, so be careful. We'd all like to see how NIST reached its conclusions in any case, but we are not allowed to see it. Structural engineers Ron Brookman made a FOIA request to NIST in 2009 asking for calculations and analysis behind NIST's claim of girder walk-off. They wrote back, "We are withholding 3,370 files. The NIST director determined that the release of these data might jeopardize public safety." And it's obvious, but NIST conclusions cannot be confirmed due to this secrecy. In this final slide, I'll try to recap the 7 points I wanted to convey. The destruction of Building 7 was unprecedented. The steel evidence was destroyed or unexplained. NIST's final theory followed years of failed hypotheses. NIST's final theory could not have been predicted. NIST's report is self-contradictory and contradicts other known facts. NIST's report is deceptive. And NIST's final theory for collapse initiation is unscientific and false. It's clear that NIST failed to explain why and how Building 7 collapsed. Today, there is no fire-based theory. We don't have one. We need a new investigation. So thank you for listening.